Well, I am really getting used to our opening music now. I mean, I liked it from the beginning, but it's what I anticipate. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining us. But I'm reflecting, given that we are just finishing up 28 years, 1990 to 2018. Is that 28 years? Yeah, I think we finished 28 years, February 11th or something like that. Or at least I finished that doing radio because there wasn't a we, Stand to Reason, when I started. Stand to Reason started in 1993. I started radio in 1990, so I was 90, 1, 2, 3. I was 4 years into my fourth year's radio when we started STR. We've been here almost 25 years, so that would be, yeah, I think we're finishing up our 28th year coming February. And I had some other music that opened up for two decades or more, and then our friends from Little Giants. I always want to say Little Green Giants. I don't know why, because it's Little Giants. Good Little Giants. See, I get it wrong every time. Oh, my goodness. Good thing they're our friends, right? The Good Little Giants and their wonderful opening music that we adopted a couple of years ago. And now I've gotten used to it, so it's like a friendly song. I look forward to it, and it's like gets me going here at the beginning of our show called Stand to Reason. I'll be taking your calls here in just a bit. And for those who need the number, just so you know, it's 855-243-9975. 855-243-9975 is our direct line. And, of course, you have to call when we're here. And our live show, that is when we are doing radio, is Tuesday evenings from 4 until 6 Los Angeles time. So you just do the math and give us a call. You know, there's something new that Melinda had thought up. I wish I would have thought of it because it was such a good idea, but I got to give her credit for it. Is many of you, you don't know if you can get in when you call in, and you're not sure, and you don't know if you want to wait all that time to get in when you do get on and that kind of stuff. And she implemented a kind of an appointment deal where you can set up an appointment to have your call taken, and we call you as long as you fill out the form and we know when to do it. That has worked out really well. And that information, I think, is on our website. Is that right? STR.org. And if you go to the radio drop-down, it's STR.org/training/broadcast. So if you type in that URL or just go to our website and look under training and then choose broadcast, then you'll find a place where you can fill in the form and we can make a date for you and me to have a chat on the air. And that helps everybody. So we just wanted to recommend that to you. But if you want to take your shot, 855-243-9975. I have been saying for years from the very beginning, actually two things now that I think about it. One of them is that we wanted to raise up through the efforts of the radio show an army of clear-thinking Christians. And after 25 years, I think we can say we've got that. We got so many people listen to this broadcast and so many people tell us how it has powerfully impacted them in their ability to engage in a thoughtful, gracious, incisive, compelling way for the kingdom of God as an ambassador for Christ. And when you've got thousands and thousands of people, that's kind of like an army. So I think that's come to pass. But another thing that I have said is I want to teach you not just what to think. So I'm not telling you here's the right thing to believe. I want to do it in such a way that it helps you to see the rationale behind it. I don't want to just give you a point of view. I want to give you an argument. And in the process of giving you an argument and working through it, you will see how thinking works, how good thinking works, hopefully. Hopefully my thinking is good. And you'll know it by listening to the ideas and the rationale and seeing if the conclusions follow properly from the reasons that I give. So a huge part of what Stand to Reason is about is teaching you how to think so you take that tool into other areas of life. Now, with that in mind, that kind of a predicate to what I want to say here, I listen to the introduction of an interview on a secular station with a secular talk show host who is actually a religious person, person, Michael Medved. And I was a little surprised when I heard the introduction, because he said he was going to introduce, he was going to have an interview with an author about a new book on heaven. And he said, it's a great book, and I really encourage everyone to buy it. And I'm thinking, what new book on heaven escaped my notice that a religious person would be endorsing, in the sense that, as a talk show host, he's telling his listeners to get it? And then he said, and my guest today is Michael Shermer. Now, Michael Shermer is the editor, founder and editor of Skeptic Magazine, and probably the most well-known American atheist. And I know Michael because I debated Mike on radio for 3 hours. We sat right next to each other, shoulder to shoulder, on Hugh Hewitt's national radio broadcast. And that broadcast is available somewhere, I think. I don't know where, is it? We have the transcript on our site, and that will be posted probably in Amy's blog tomorrow, okay? But in any event, the summary of the show, you know how we do that. But you can get the information there. But I was side to side with Michael Shermer. He's an atheist, and I actually don't know if he's a materialist, but I think he is. In other words, that it's the material world that's all that's real. So Michael Shermer writing a book on heaven? Really? Well, it must be a book that is meant to disparage or dispute the idea of heaven as construed by religious folk, all right? And now I'm going to tell you something that may sound like a liability at this point, but I don't think it is. And what I'm and that is that I didn't listen to the discussion. I was in the car. I'm in and out. And so I don't know what Michael Shermer wrote in his book about heaven, but I have a pretty good idea because I know Michael Shermer's point of view in general. Also, I heard the title of the book. And so since I started out by talking about teaching you how to think, not just what to think, I'm going to point out something in the title of the book, actually two things, that are giveaways as to problems with the approach that Michael Shermer is taking. All right? Now, could I be mistaken? Yes. You didn't read the book. No, I didn't read the book. You didn't listen to the interview. No, I didn't listen to the interview. Then how do you know that it's a mistake? Well, it's the way the title is worded that leads off a certain way that raises two concerns about the approach. Okay, so what's the title of the book? The title of the book is Heavens on Earth. All right. In other words, doesn't the title, in dealing with the question of heaven, I'll read the subtitle in a moment, doesn't the title suggest to you that the only heaven you're going to get is the one that's on earth? And by the way, that might be true. Maybe it is the only heaven that you're going to get is the one on earth. And that would be fully consistent with Michael Shermer's point of view as an atheist, as a so-called skeptic. And I did catch a couple of lines when I got back into the car after going somewhere. I just popped it back on again, and he was talking about how at this time in the history of the world, we got it pretty good because most people in history lived in abject poverty, and now we've got technology and politics and medicine and all kinds of things that really help us to live a much better life than we ever lived. By the perspective of most people in history, we would now be living in heaven. I think that was kind of his point. All right. And I, like I said, I suspect that's the point of his book. Let me read the subtitle, though. And this is what betrays, I think, the problem. The subtitle to his book, Michael Shermer's book, Heavens on Earth, is The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, immortality and utopia. Now, please do not read into my anything I've said so far that I'm putting Michael Shermer down. I'm not. He's a decent human being. We had a very spirited discussion a few years back as we debated the existence of God on the radio, and people can make their own decisions about who they thought made the better case, okay? This is not disparagement. What I want to teach you or point out to you is a way of thinking about these things. Sometimes things are going on in the background that you need to be aware of. So why is the notion of the scientific search for the afterlife, immortality, and utopia a concern? Okay? What it suggests is that if you want to know the truth about anything, the place to get the truth about it is from science. Science is the standard of knowledge. That is, if science weighs in on it in the affirmative, then you can pretty much count on it as being true. And in the negative, then it's probably not. Now, Michael Shermer would acknowledge, to be fair to him, and he brought this up on the show, science is on the debate. Science is a self-correcting enterprise. I actually think that's a bit overstated, simply because science is not completely apolitical, that issues of philosophy and prior metaphysical commitments does influence how you read the evidence. And I actually think this is an example of that. But nevertheless, it does have a way, a means, if allowed to correct itself. Okay. But I just want you to think for a moment about the notion. Is science the final arbiter of what is true? The scientific search for the afterlife. Oh, you want to take your guesses, you religious people. You can do your little faith thing, but if you want to know something about what's real, science is the way to find out. So here is the first mistake, and that is kind of a subtle imposition of scientism on the process. Science is the thing that tells you the truth about it. That is the measure of knowledge. Okay. Now, I just want to point something out. If you haven't thought about this before, science cannot work on its own. There's got to be a whole bunch of things that are true first before science can be employed as a means to find out other things that are true. You have to have the truth of the basic reliability of your senses. You have to have certain moral things be in place. You have to have procedural things be in place before science can even begin working, okay? Well, who tells us about that? It ain't science, it's philosophy, specifically the philosophy of science. What science is and how it works and whether or not you can trust the results of science are not scientific questions. They are philosophical questions about science. And all that is meant to underscore is that science can't be the sole arbiter of truth, because if that were the case, science itself couldn't even get off the ground. It is a legitimate means of discovering certain things, that is, things pertaining to, say, the physical universe, but it doesn't mean that it's the only way to find out something true, and if science doesn't weigh in on it, then it can't be relied on, because that piece of truth is not something that science can tell you about. Science itself can't tell you whether science is reliable as opposed to some other means of truth. That's a different kind of question. So it starts out with a tacit assumption that science is the queen of the disciplines, and there aren't any second runners. Science tells you truth, and other things, everything else is just an opinion. And indeed, I think that is Michael Shermer's view. He said, I used to be a Christian, and then I discovered science. Now I believe not in God, but I believe in science. That is, science is the way we learn things that are true. Well, there are a lot of ways we learn things that are true. Science may be one of them. but they're more than that. And so even if science does not give us positive evidence for the afterlife, we could have good reasons to believe in the afterlife. That's the point I'm making. It isn't like all these other reasons are somehow second rate. So that's the first point. Here's the second point. Science can't tell us about the afterlife because science is only equipped to weigh in on things pertaining to the physical universe. The afterlife, by definition, is non-physical. By its nature, I should say, is non-physical. And so science can't tell us about it. Now, are you saying that there's no scientific studies that have to do with near-death experiences? No, there are scientific studies, but notice how they proceed. They don't proceed based on empirical evidence except for the evidence that the body is dead. Science says this body's dead. Flat EKG, flat EEG. No one's home. Science can tell you that. But it can't tell you anything about near-death experiences. How do you find out about that? Someone else has got to testify to them. The one who has the experience, who comes back when the body is now alive and can talk to you. That's where the information is coming from. So it is testimony of an individual that gives you the kind of information that allows you to conclude whether or not his testimony about the afterlife he experienced, wherever he went or she went, is veridical or not, truthful or not. Now, it turns out that there's a lot of compelling stuff. There is a thing called remote viewing. And here I mean where the person leaves the body, according to the testimony, the story goes this way. The person leaves the body and goes somewhere else and witnesses something that happens and brings information back that when the person is back in the body is now alive and the person is there with it, and the person can say, I just went went to this place, such and so, and I saw so and or I heard so and so say this and that. Or I saw this and that take place. And then can give the detail, which then can be checked out to see if that actually took place in a place where the body was not present. And if it did, now we have evidence from personal testimony that is shown to be veridical, truthful, that the person did in fact go to these places. You can see the connection, by the way. If the person went down the hall and witnessed this event in the hospital, then came back and told about it, when the individual's body could never have access to that information, you can see how that would be really good evidence that the soul left the body and went down and did this. Now, if you'd reject that, it could only be because of metaphysical commitments that are inconsistent with the testimony just given. And when you say, no, that can't happen because that's not what I believe is true about the world, well, now your own biases are dismissing evidence to the contrary. That's not good research, okay, or science, if you will. I have heard Michael Shermer weigh in on near-death experiences, and he was dismissive. He said, well, if you spin a person around a whole bunch of times, they're going to see a light at the end of the tunnel. That's what he said. Well, we're not talking about light at the end of the tunnel. We're talking about remote viewing where actual information is gained because you visited a different place that your body was not at. How are you going to do that? By spinning a person around a bunch of times. No, I think there's evidence that needs to be dealt with. But notice that I even before I get to the information in the book, I know there are two false moves. One is the appeal to science as the implicit appeal to science as the chief means by which we know something. And therefore, if science can't give us evidence for it, then it's probably not real or not true. And then the attempt to apply science to the immaterial realm, which it is not capable of speaking to directly. And of course, you're going to come up with nil because science is not geared to measure that, and if science then is the only thing that can speak legitimately about something, and it comes up with nil, then you're going to dismiss the afterlife, heaven, as a mere fantasy. Wishful thinking. We've always wanted a utopia. I can pretty much bank on this as the thrust of the book. We've always wanted a utopia. We projected it into the afterlife. We need to build utopia here. The scientific search for the afterlife, immortality, and utopia. Heaven's on earth. Sounds like what his point of view is. Regardless, however he prosecutes the issue, if he prosecutes it from a scientistic perspective, that science is the one that is really tells you the truth about things, and if it's not science, then you can't rely on it, that's false. That's demonstrably false. And the attempt to even apply that empirical method to questions of a non-empirical nature, the afterlife, that's also another false step. You're not going to get the right answers by using that methodology. How do you assess it? By different means. Testimony is a good one. If people go away and come back again, their bodies are dead, but they're still alive, boy, that ought to tell you something. Maybe there is life after death. And how do we know that? By their testimony, for one, of remote viewing experiences. That can get right at it in a way that sounds like it could be reliable. Okay, just something to chew on. Those are tools of assessment, all right? How to think, not necessarily what to think. All right, let's take a break and come back to your calls on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Are you wondering where to get started as an ambassador for Christ? We've put together a fresh approach to help you grow in knowledge, wisdom, and character. Go to str.org, follow the Start Here link under Training. You'll find fun videos, informational resources, and key articles. The more you train, the better you can engage others with confidence, courage, and grace. Don't miss the quiz at the bottom of the page where you can test the skills you've learned as an ambassador for Christ. Simply follow the Get Started link under the Training section at the top of the webpage at str.org.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
Greg Kokel here, and by the way, anybody interested in that issue of near-death experiences, J.P. Moreland and Gary Habermas have written a fabulous book together. It's been out for a while. In fact, it's gone through two editions, and the new title is it Beyond Death? Is that the more? And when they updated it with a new title, they might have gotten a different publisher, but they Gary Habermas did the material on near-death experiences, and he updated it, so he gave more information. And I will tell you this, even that book was 8 or 10 years ago, and since then, there have been lots more research done by way of testimony of people who have had near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences and experiences of remote viewing that are shown to be veridical, truthful, based on the evidential nature of it. So you can actually have concrete, reliable evidence that this actually happened, because of the nature of remote viewing and the information that people get. So Beyond Death is a great book. It covers a number of different bases, but a big section in there on near-death experiences by Gary Habermas, and he is very, very, very careful with the research. And incidentally, Amy just told me the way things are being done now. I said something about Amy's blog, and it used to be that After the broadcast, then Amy would put like a summary or something about the on the blog and some links, and here's what we talked about, and here's where you can go. This has all been made more streamlined and easier for you. If you go to the broadcast page from our website, so that would be str.org, then to training, and then to broadcast, right? Is that the way you told it to me? Okay, on the page where you can actually listen to the podcast, all right? So that's probably what you access when you want to listen to a podcast, or on the app. All the information for that particular podcast is listed. So if I make a reference to a book and there's a link, you'll find it there. If I make reference to an article that we've done like the Michael Shermer debate where we have the transcription, that's going to be right there too. So all of the relevant information for any given podcast will be right there on that podcast page. So it's one-stop shopping, and you can reference anything that I've mentioned. So there you go. All right. Hey, let's go to Ann in North Carolina. Ann, thank you for waiting. Nice to have you on board.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call and for your radio ministry. Congratulations. 28 years on the air.
Well, incredible. Thank you. Thank you. I always am uncertain. I just have to go back and start counting years on my fingers to make sure I got the right numbers. But I think we're just finishing our 28th year.
Incredible.
Thank you.
So a question I have is actually a personal conflict I have with a family member. I want to get your perspective on it. Excuse me. I'm having difficulty reconciling my Christian values with showing hospitality to my gay cousin and his boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
Just a little background on the issue is that we moved out to North Carolina in April from Southern California.
Uh-huh.
And we stayed with my cousin and his boyfriend for 2 months while we closed on the home. And during that time, we developed a close relationship.
Good.
And we spoke openly with one another about Christianity, God, and homosexuality. And we always respected each other's point of view on it.
Good.
However, the conflict began when they came to visit us and stay with us over the weekend when we bought the house. And when it came to bedtime, I expressed to my cousin that I'd like for them to sleep in separate beds, though I'm making an exception by allowing them to sleep in the same room. And unfortunately, he was offended by my request, and we had a heated exchange that evening as well as the next day. Since then, we've reconciled. But he stated to me that he will no longer come to my home, and we are still welcome at his house.
Uh-huh.
But they will not come over to our home in the future because of the boundaries that we established. So question I have for you is that should we reconsider with staying with them in the future? By doing that, are we being hypocritical? That was one of the arguments that he stated. Should we amend our house rules so we can continue to grow our relationship with them and showing hospitality to them? I know that in the gay community, they value hospitality
very much. Sure, of course, right.
And by withholding it, is it making us seem, quote-unquote, un-Christian? Are we being
right. Well, as far as I could tell, just quickly on that point, you're not withholding hospitality. They are welcome in your home under certain, given certain sleeping circumstances. They are welcome in your home, so you are not ceasing to extend hospitality to them. It seems to me. So I have just file that away. I mean that you are even if you say we would like you to sleep in separate beds, you are still making your home available with hospitality to them. You're not closing your doors and saying, you can't come here. You're saying you can, but this is what we like. So if you're thinking that you are denying them hospitality, or if they are saying you are denying hospitality, I don't think that's true. I think you are offering them hospitality. Now, it is on your terms, just like it would be on their terms if they asked you to stay in their home. Okay. Now, they're not asking you to sleep in separate beds, but the reason is they don't think that you sleeping with your husband is immoral, you know? So they're not going to be inclined to do that. But they would. It seems to me that in their home, they would be within their rights for making requests that are consistent with their values. So what if they invited you over to their house and you were wearing T-shirts that condemn same-sex marriage and homosexuality, would they be within their rights to say, you know what, we'd like to have you here, but you can't wear that T-shirt? Because that is a condemnation of us. And you are welcome in our home, but you can't say those kinds of things on your T-shirt. I think that would be entirely appropriate for them to make that request of you. And if you said, well, I'm not going to come into your home if I can't wear the T-shirt I want to wear, I think the smallness would not be on their side, but on your side. That is, you're willing to sacrifice the relationship or the hospitable involvement there, you being their guest, for the sake of the T-shirt you're wearing. Now, they might say, well, look, they're not saying it's a T-shirt. They're saying it's not sleeping together. But on one level, it's the same. That is, people who have the home can make the boundaries based on their moral sensibilities. All right. And I think that's reasonable. And I don't think it's onerous for them to ask you not to wear the T-shirt. And I don't think it's onerous for you to ask them not to sleep in the same bed. It's not a burdensome requirement. Okay. Now, what they said was, I'm offended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this becomes the blanket charge. People feel they could say they're offended to anything, and that means that you've got to do what they say because what you said offended them. Now, what I'm curious about, and I don't think you should have a big fight with people with them. You have a good relationship with them, and I think you should sustain it. I think it probably was a mistake, just tactically speaking, for you to have them to arrange for them to come over, but not let them know about the sleeping arrangements until they were there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it would have been better if you said, we'd love to have you over, but you know where we are in this circumstance, in this situation, and it would be difficult for us, given what you know to be our moral standards, if you stayed with us and shared the same bed. Because being in the same house, even in the same room, that's not a problem for us. You having your points of view, but that's not a problem for us. But sleeping in the same bed would be one for us. That violates our conscience. And so we would like you to sleep in separate beds if you come over. Is that okay with you? Now, letting them know in advance allows them to opt out if they want to opt out. But see, here's the part, and I think that's fair. Okay, you want to opt out? I understand it. But the part that is on the merits is confusing to me. I'm not confused that they'd say it, but I don't understand the merits of it, that they're offended. What's offensive about that? They already know your view. They know you think this is wrong. Why should they be offended by this? And I think this is a child's ploy, frankly. It's something I hear all the time. I had a PhD in philosophy stand up to the microphone and tell me that there was something that I said in my presentation on the problem of evil that offended him. And what I wanted to say was, gee, I'm sorry, I thought I was talking to adults. He's a PhD in philosophy, and he was offended by my point of view. So, you know, I think this is a child's ploy, personally. Well, maybe you should grow up a little bit. Maybe you shouldn't be so easily offended. Now, I never say this to the people, because that's not going to help anything. But I do think this is an immature response. Mm-hmm. Grow up.
The irony is that his argument as to why he was offended was because he's over 30 now, as his boyfriend. Why are we restricting him in such a way? Which is one of the arguments. So it's funny that you mentioned that.
Oh, well, wait a minute. But that doesn't speak to the issue at all. Okay,
right.
You're over 30. Why can't you wear a T-shirt that says, you know, AIDS cures fags or something like that? Now, I'm not promoting that, just so everybody knows, but that was a famous line from a sign that was held up by a a so-called Christian pastor who has now gone to his reward, such as it is, and Phelps. And he, you know, I thought it was grotesque. And most people would consider it a grotesque. But is it somehow a defense of wearing this grotesque T-shirt in the home of a gay couple that you are now over 30? Do you see what I'm saying? It's irrelevant. The problem isn't that they're not old enough to make their own decisions. The issue is whether they should be pursuing behavior in the home of people who find that behavior to be deeply immoral. And it seems to me the answer of anyone visiting anybody else's house is, no, I'm not going to do anything in your home that's going to offend you. That is the grown-up response. And so appealing to his age, I'm 30. Well, good. Then you're grown up enough to understand the point I'm making.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole I'm offended routine, I think, is infantile.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Especially when you've had a healthy relationship up until this point, and now, as you said, they're offended. There was a heated discussion when you wanted to put these boundaries. I don't have the foggiest idea what they consider hypocritical about it. What is hypocritical about what you said?
I believe what they felt was hypocritical, or
yes,
the conversation with my cousin. The boyfriend actually didn't mind at all, and he's the one who doesn't have a religious background, whereas my cousin, we both went to Bible college, and we
right.
know the word, and he's more on the camp of Christianity, allows for homosexual relationships. But besides that, he us staying with them for the 2 months, seems like we were okay with staying with a homosexual couple.
Right.
Whereas now, when we're reciprocating the hospitality, allowing them to stay, we're imposing our values on them, whereas they didn't impose anything on us.
And right. Okay. So
okay. That was his argument.
Okay. So that might be unfair. You're imposing something on us that we didn't impose on you. That's not fair. It might be inconsistent. It didn't bother you when we slept in a Rome room, and now it bothers you when we do the same thing at your house. How is it hypocritical? You see, this is another infantile response. Here's a convenient word I can use, a name I can call a religious person a hypocrite. Well, that word, a hypocrite is a faker. A hypocrite is somebody who says one thing but does something entirely different because he doesn't really believe what he's saying. That's what a hypocrite is, okay? I don't see anything hypocritical here, okay? This seems to me just an attempt to embarrass you by calling you a name, okay? Now, the difference to me is quite obvious, and it could be explained to any adult. When we are staying at your house, we are living under your rules. And we will abide by whatever rules that you set up. We don't tell you where to sleep in your own house. It isn't for us to tell you how to live in your house. However, in our house, we have different rules. It is up to us to tell you how you sleep in our house, not you to tell us how you sleep in our house. Well, again, this is a distinction that I think adults can get. It's not difficult. It's not tricky. Okay? So, I'm just trying to straighten this mess, this rhetoric mess out. Okay? Mm-hmm. As to the merits or the issue itself, you have to decide with your husband. I think this is a personal choice, and different people are going to have different points of view about this. Do you consider it, do you and your husband, do you feel violated in some personal way with a same-sex couple cohabiting under your roof? If the answer is yes, then it's appropriate for you to say, please don't do that in our home. What you do in your own home is your business. But in our home, we don't feel comfortable with that. Now, with that in mind, you can stay at a hotel down the street and sleep together and then come visit us during the day, and we have no difficulty with that because when you visit and have dinner with us, you're not doing anything immoral in our house, according to our views. So you're welcome to come and visit if you want. We'd like to have it. We like you. We have a relationship with you, but we don't want you doing what we consider immoral in our house. Not hypocritical. What you do in your house is your own business because you're the masters of your home. This is not tricky, but I'm not at all surprised that you have run into the conflict because in our own home, we had a similar situation when it was actually my in-law's home, and it was a visitor of theirs, a relative, that they were. It was the exact same kind of thing. And, he blew a gasket when they made this request for that reason. He said that they were not Christian, they were unkind, they were unloving, and all these other things, which was nothing of the case. But it was just simply a way of lashing back at a restriction or requirement he didn't like. I think anybody who is acting like a grown-up, and pardon me for the judgment, but it's there. Anybody acting like a grown-up is not going to say, when you make this boundary in your own home, that's hypocritical, that is offensive. They already know your view. They're going to say, well, as a grown-up, I'm either going to go along with it and honor your request of what you want in your own home or not. If they value the relationship, they'll honor the request because it's not a burdensome request. One night, two nights, sleeping in different beds, respecting the people whose home they're staying in, that's not burdensome. Frankly, I'm sure that you would show the same respect to any boundaries that they had in their own home that was relevant to their own moral sensibilities. Make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. Unfortunately, I don't think he views it that same way. It's more of a burden to him.
Yeah.
Because it's perpetual. Even if they do get married, I don't acknowledge their marriage as being true.
Yeah.
Legitimate. So mm-hmm. even in the future when they do, they still won't be able to have that luxury of staying in the same bed with each other.
Right.
And he feels that it's, even though he's welcome in our home, he can't fully enjoy a hospitality knowing that we don't accept their relationship.
Yeah, okay, well, that's immaturity. I'm just going to label it. That is immaturity. That is childish, not childlike. That is childish. You have to approve and affirm everything about me or I can't have any kind of relationship with you. Are you kidding me? Now, you're not acting, you're not acting in an untoward manner towards these people. You know, you are extending a friendly hand to them, but you're not going to affirm what they want you to affirm. And it is childish for a grown-up people. It is childish for grown-up people to demand that others share their same values in these controversial areas in order to have any kind of relationship with them. Why don't you tell them? What if you were to say, you know what? We will not have anything to do with you if you don't condemn same-sex marriage. I mean, that would be ridiculous. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not asking you to do that. You are showing a charitable hospitality to them, and you're placing a restriction that is reasonable, I think, given your own values and moral sensibilities. Now, by the way, some Christians may not feel that way. They may not be offended by that, and they will just... We don't demand that non-Christians live like Christians. That would be inappropriate. But when they're in your house, look at, if you had children, right? We don't tell non-Christians not to swear. That they can swear if they want. It's up to them. They can use all kinds of foul language. That's their business. They come into our home? Okay, then you zip it, right? You use language that's appropriate to our household. Wouldn't that be an appropriate thing to say? Is that hypocritical? Is that offensive? How dare you? You're telling me not to say the F word or the S word or the GD word. Oh, you're such a hypocrite. I use those words in my house when you came over to visit me. Grown-ups see the difference. But I don't expect that folks who advance the view that your friends are advancing to be grown up in this regard. They just are not. I'm sorry to say that. I wish it was, but it's not, characteristically. There are exceptions, but characteristically, that's not the way it works. So,
Anne, I
hope that's helpful.
Yes, it was very much so. Thank you for affirming what my husband and I have set out to do in setting the standards in our home. Appreciate that very much.
Okay. All right. All the best to you, Anne.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back to our last caller for this hour. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason.
Without realizing it, our students are being shaped by the ideas around them. News, social media, movies, friends, and teachers are all shaping how they think about the world. And what they believe about the world will determine how they live in the world. That's why I'm so excited to tell you about this year's Rethink Apologetics Student Conference. Our theme this year is all about worldview. When students come to Rethink, they will get equipped. No topic is off limits, so bring your questions and press in for answers. They will engage top speakers. We've invited some of the brightest Christian minds to interact with them on tough topics, and they will enjoy themselves. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic or somewhere in between, we guarantee that they're going to have fun. So join us in Dallas at Cottonwood Creek Church on March 2nd and 3rd, and in Alabama at Briarwood Presbyterian Church on April 20th and 21st. It's time to rethink how we see the world.
Hi, my name is Alan Schliemann. We are seeing a rise in the number of people arguing that it's morally permissible to kill disabled, born human beings. Find out why in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the top of the homepage at str.org.
All right, a quick word on things coming up. Many of you know about Rethink, of course. The Rethink Apologetics Student Conference, March 2nd and 3rd at Cottonwood Creek in Dallas. Now, this is geared for students, but we're not checking IDs. So you can bring, moms and dads can come. They do. And youth leaders come. And if you're just astray, you can still come. We got 750 people signed up already for that Dallas. We're still 4 weeks out. Okay, that's about as much as we've ever had in Dallas at the two prior rethinks. All right, so we're going to probably blow through 1,000 on this one, and maybe even more. So, and we hope that that's you. All right, so we got J. Warner Wallace, we got Walter Strickland, we got Christopher Ewan, we got John Stone Street, we got Amy Hall, we got Tim Barnett, we got Alan Schliemann, we got yours truly, in my humble opinion. A fabulous lineup of speakers, and they will equip your young people to answer for the hope that's within them in a way that no one else can, and it's going to be a lot of fun, all right? So go to rethinkapologetics.com, rethinkapologetics.com, and sign up. Time's a-wasting, March 2nd and 3rd, Cottonwood Creek Church in Dallas. That would be North Dallas. And April 20th or 21st at Briarwood Pres, in Birmingham. So if you're in that neck of the woods, that's the one you want to go to. Pretty much the same lineup, but it's going to be fabulous. It's a month later, and actually 6 weeks later. So, and we'd love to see you there as well. Another conference coming up, the AMP conference. That is the Apologetics Mission Pathway. Is that right? AMP. AMP. That's the Reasons to Believe. It's going to be in San Dimas, February 23rd and 24th. So you got about a month away right now. And if you want to, that's Hugh Ross in the crowd. J.P. Moreland will be there, Fuzz Rana, and, of course, Hugh, Paul Copan, Jeff Zwierink. I mean, this is another one. It's more science stuff related to defending the faith. We love those folks out there, and we encourage you to consider the AMP conference. If you go and enter the promotional code AMPPartner, that shows that you got the info from us. You'll get a 20% off registration. All right. So that's coming up in February. And this weekend coming up, Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills, Sunday, February 4th and 11th. So I'm going to be teaching the huge Calvary Chapel. There's 8,000 people there. I'm thrilled. Chino Hills. All the services on Sunday, February 4th and 11th, I'm going to be doing kind of tactics, Columbo 1 and Columbo 2. And I'm looking forward to to that session this weekend. So if you're in Southern California, you can attend that. Okay, let's go to, let's see. Oh, hey, here we go. Chris in Tucson, Arizona. I was just in Scottsdale last weekend, Chris.
Yeah, that's right. As a matter of fact, I was up there at the conference and got to meet you.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Did we chat? We chatted, I guess, huh?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
Did we chat at the conference?
A little bit. You were, I don't want to take this wrong, but I was surprised how personable you were. Because, I mean, I'm expecting, you go around the world and you talk to thousands of people. And here I'm in line waiting to register, and you just walk up and, shaking hands and everything.
Oh,
and
good. Well, look it, I'm just one of the boys. That's the way I look at it, Chris. So I'm glad I made a good first impression. How about the second impression? Was that good? As good as the first? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, my wife was there, and she was just, she was very enthralled with the, you gave the tactics presentation.
Right.
And she was just busily taking notes. And
okay,
stuff.
Well,
yeah.
Great. I did have a good time personally. I sure did. So
good.
Okay, so what's on your mind, Chris?
I'll try to present this right now. I was talking to, Amy, the call screener, trying
right.
to get across my point. So anyway, I did write it down, so I'll see if it comes across okay.
All right.
Anyway, as citizens, we're sometimes forced through laws and taxes to support government actions that we might find immoral or against our conscience.
Right.
In fact, I read that George Washington, he actually wrote to a Quaker pacifist saying that although war was against Quaker beliefs, as citizens, Quakers were obliged to take up arms to defend the country.
Uh-huh.
So my question is, would you agree with that principle as far as supporting a country? Is that any different
question is more, that's right, your question is more about taxes. I'm just mindful of the time here because this is the last call of the segment. And so I'm not going to take on the George Washington and the pacifists and the Quakers. That's another issue. But the general one now that we're faced with is the taxes one. And is it wrong to pay taxes when the money will go to things we oppose? I have a couple thoughts on this. First, just a biblical observation. There were all kinds of things that the Roman government, to whom the Jews paid taxes, were involved with that weren't kosher. Hey, that's actually kind of a pun. I did that by accident. But in any event, I'm glad you chuckled. that was better than I thought. Actually, I didn't think. I just said it. But sometimes you get a freebie. All right. So they weren't kosher, right, that they were doing. But Jesus, when he was asked about the tax, he just said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God, which is a little bit of a cryptic response. But there was another point where he did say, go fish go toss a hook in, get the fish, take the coin out of the mouth, and pay the tax. And so Jesus was willing to pay the tax, and frankly, I wish I could get my tax money out of the mouth of a big mouth bass. But when you're the Son of God, you can pull that kind of thing off, And in fact, maybe like a 12 to 15 pounder at that, I think what we can take away from it is Jesus did not feel apparently morally compromised when he paid a tax to the Roman government, even though tax money, in one sense, can be used for illicit, non-kosher kind of enterprises, right?
Can I interject something real quick?
Sure.
I think maybe with the tax, that kind of steered you in the wrong direction. I guess the point I'm kind of getting at was, people will say, well, you pay taxes to support things you don't agree with. There's no difference, say, the government forcing a baker or a forest to participate in a wedding. Can you distinguish between those two?
Well, yeah, because in the case of paying a tax, you're dropping your money down a big black hole, right? Okay?
Uh-huh.
And how that corporate money gets spent is up to the government. It isn't like they're taking your coin and they're using your coin to fund an abortion, all right? It doesn't work that way. It goes into the general fund, so to speak. And then they do all kinds of different things. You could, if you want to tell yourself this, say that the tax money that you are paying is paying for the highways. Somebody else is paying for the abortion, right?
That's a little better, yeah.
Okay, so I mean, it's just the way the mechanics of it work. In the case of the baker himself is baking a cake. Which cake will go to this event that he has difficulty being supportive of for moral reasons? Do you see the difference?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if a non-believer would necessarily see the distinction.
Well, I don't know why he wouldn't, because it doesn't have to do with whether you believe in God or Christianity or the moral things at all. All you got to be able to see is, in one case, you are not participating directly. You're just giving money to an organization that then uses some of that money to do things that you don't agree with. In the other case, it is your actual behaviors that are participating in a thing that you don't agree with. All right. Like, for example, what if a gay T-shirt printer didn't want to print a T-shirt that says AIDS cures fags? Not my line, by the way, but a grotesque line, right, that was advanced by someone else. But I use it because it is so offensive. It makes the point. I don't think he should be required to publish that, to print those. He is
right,
participating in the making of this T-shirt that is directly offensive in its and potentially encourages violence against gays. An argument could be made. So I wouldn't say that he's required to do that. I'll take it to somebody else and let them do it. So I don't think there's a parallel here between these two circumstances. Okay, I just don't.
Okay.
I think that there's a significant difference. And I think it's obvious, not based on whether one agrees with the point itself, same-sex marriage or whatever. It's obvious that the participation is different in both cases. All right?
Yep.
Chris, thank you for the call, and it's nice to chat with you after our brief encounter there in Scottsdale, and all the best to you. Say hi to your wife for me. And that's it for our show, friends. Thank you so much for being a part of it. And I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye.